This week on HZ Running, what does identity have to do with change? Well, a lot, according to Brad Stolberg, and we examine how he breaks it down in the second section of his book.
How do carbon super shoes respond to cold temperatures? We answer a listener question about that very thing.
In the world of running, the Houston Half Marathon saw a new record from an unexpected source.
An absurdly fast road race raised eyebrows.
And records are also falling on the track.
All this and more on A to Z Running. Hey, welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I am Zach. And just a reminder that you can learn everything you need to know about the things we do at a2zrunning.com and follow us on the places where we are followable, like Instagram, Spotify, YouTube. And for those of you who did not know, you can both listen and watch on Spotify. They've got that new video feature. I don't know how new it is, but we just realized they have that. There's also an interaction component, though, to Spotify that's even a little bit more, shall we say, rigorous than the traditional just like writing a comment on things. And there's like a Q&A kind of dynamic with every single episode. So you're welcome to interact with us. Not just welcome, but fully invited with all the enthusiasm we can invite you to do the thing, because we like to interact with you more than anything else. That's the stuff we like to do the most. So comment on the places, ask the questions where you can find us, and we would love to see and hear more of your thoughts.
With that same enthusiasm, we also want to invite your feedback into how we can better do this thing, our podcast. If you have thoughts about it, if you like the format, if you'd like to see anything changed or different, we like your feedback, because that helps inform us as to how best serve you to help runners thrive.
Andy at least wants your feedback. I think we are perfect in every single way.
Oh, goodness.
And so why would we change
anything?
Except
for all of Zach's sarcasm. That's the thing.
Hey, by the way, if you're in the Midwest, at least, winter happened quite suddenly, and we've been buried under feet of snow.
That's not an exaggeration.
That's not an exaggeration.
At least where we are. We're getting like smashed.
So there's a thing, for those of you who don't live near large lakes, then you're not aware of this term. Having lived near a large lake my entire life, I thought this was just commonplace, but people have told me that that's not a normal thing that people talk about. They call it lake effect snow. And so what that means is when it's not really snowing most places, it's still snowing on you if you have lake effect snow. And so that's why we got, you know, at times an additional foot more than we should have probably gotten. But that's how it goes. As it were, the reason I'm bringing this up at all is because things like that have a major effect on running and training. And it reminds us of two things, I think. The one is how much I appreciate things like indoor running facilities and treadmills. And I know we as runners often like to hate on the treadmill, but at the same time, what a luxury to be able to say, rather than try to hike through a foot of snow right now, I'm just going to run in my dry and warm basement. Actually, my basement's cold, but for running versus outside in the snow, it's warm. That's an amazing thing, right? Or I'm going to go to the gym that has like a lot of other people exercising together, and it kind of feels like you're doing a thing socially, even though you don't have to interact with people, which is also great for introverted people like myself who much prefer the faux interaction where we're just around each other but not actually talking. Anyway, my point is, the reason why I'm saying all of this is because we have talked to many of you who have been frustrated by things like this moment of weather. And so we're happy to field, in fact, a listener question today that relates to the cold weather running, but also these are good times to wonder about things like, what effect does snow have on my running mechanic? And what effect does slipperiness or uneven terrain? Or are the ice spikes better than the yak tracks, better than, you know, all that kind of stuff? Those have always been great questions, and they're very timely. And so as things like that are on your mind, ask them. We'd love to hear what specifically you're thinking about, and we can talk more about that precisely. But also, if you're thinking about that, we're right there with you. We are thinking about it too.
Speaking of which, let's get on to that question. This listener question is from Laura. She writes, "One thing I was just thinking about, I remember Zach mentioning once that the value of super shoes basically diminishes or goes away entirely under a certain temperature. But I don't remember what that temp is, and also wondering then, what do you guys race in cold temps? Are all shoes less efficient in the cold? So it still makes sense to wear super shoes. Or is it specifically the carbon plate or the foam that is less efficient? Wondering how you guys would alter your race shoe choice in cold temps."
Hmm. I also don't remember, Laura. So next question. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, well, so I don't know that we shared a specific temperature. And if we did, I don't have that anymore. I'm not sure where that specifically came from. There have been some examinations, and I can't point to a specific study that has a substantial enough study body of work, I should say, that points to some kind of generalizable thing. But there are principles here. And so, for example, shoes of all kinds, as you were asking, Laura, do respond to temperatures. And so extreme heat makes shoes a little bit squishier than they're supposed to be, and extreme cold makes them a little bit stiffer than they're supposed to be. And our comment is that by the very nature of what makes a super shoe super, which is the foam, not the carbon plate. Carbon plate's a piece of the puzzle, but if you look at the test data on super shoes, then they will show you that any shoe with adding a carbon plate with good foam makes it negligibly better than without the carbon plate. But if you upgrade that foam to what is not scientifically known as the super foam, and it depends on the brand exactly what that foam is going on there. Anyway, when you upgrade the foam, that's when you see the difference in the test results. So the foam is going to make the biggest difference in the shoe, and as it were, what makes the foam so impactful is the nature of how it both absorbs energy and returns it. And so that combination of the squish and spring, which is very unique to certain compositions and materials. And so as that happens, in colder temperatures, both of those things happen worse. And so if you take a shoe, let's call it a not super shoe, and you give it the cold temperatures, it stiffens up the shoe, just like it's going to do with any kinds of composite rubbers or foams. Now, for a shoe that is otherwise just kind of a normal shoe and it just makes it a little bit stiffer, that's not really changing much about the running experience. For the super shoe, it's changing it so substantially that it's no longer super, or it's getting much, much less super.
Personally, I have run a race that was very cold before, and I still found a benefit to having the super shoe. And I think part of it was the way that it's designed to help with your form and your mechanics. It drives you forward. And so I think there can still be a benefit by the race shoe design, even if the super foam isn't giving you the pushback, or not the pushback, you know what I'm saying, the propulsion forward.
Well, the other point, though, further still, is that I'm not necessarily arguing that going and running a race in 32 degrees in a 5K means scrap the super shoes because it's cold out, because there's a case to be made, and this is why I say there's not a large enough body of research to suggest decisions at this point in time. But, for example, foam probably is affected by temperature differently than something like water. By probably, I mean absolutely. And so if it is, if that's the case, then it probably means long exposure has a negative effect, whereas short-term exposure may have almost no effect. You have to have substantially colder temperatures. You also have to have substantially longer exposure before it really is going to do something to the responsiveness of the foam, for instance. So I don't know that if you wear super shoes for other races, I don't know that I would say, I don't wear them for the cold one because it's cold. There's a good chance that it's still having, in a sense, a net positive effect. And then there's other factors, as Andy noted, even just one of them being, if that's a shoe that you feel the most comfortable in when you're racing, you're still going to feel comfortable when you're racing, whether or not it's as responsive.
They're still lighter than my Brooks Ghost.
They're still light. They're still, yeah, right. So, no, I don't think, Laura, that you change your approach because the temperatures are colder. But I do think we see, and actually there is some kind of effort to find out exactly where this is, but we see what is clearly an optimal temperature range where the shoes seem to perform the very best at. And it's not a very narrow range. I'm not intimating that it's like the 5 degrees that are the best degrees. But point being, outside of the sense that that may in fact be the case, I don't, but why wouldn't we still wear them in the other ones?
The consideration that I would throw into this conversation is if it's so cold that it's slick, like if it's so cold that there's ice or that there are slippery conditions, then that might be more of a consideration because a lot of the super shoes have terrible traction. So I think that would be my bigger consideration if it's sometime in the winter, if the race is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the most important point in the whole thing is footing. Because when it comes down to cold weather racing, most of us are not trying to run our fastest times ever because it's just simply unlikely to happen in substantially colder temperatures. So instead, then we're really looking for what's the thing that's going to keep me upright the best and feel comfortable. Those are the two considerations. Yeah.
Thank you for the question, Laura. This was very interesting.
And if you have a question, those of you listening, and would like to ask it, we invite questions anytime by going to a2zrunning.com/questions, or you can send an email directly to us via questions@a2zrunning.com.
Let's get on to the main topic.
Last week, we began 2 weeks ago, but last week we dug deep into the first section of Brad Stahlberg's book, Master of Change, or Masters of Change? Master of Change. And as it were, expressed to you what he's trying to do with the book, essentially breaking this idea of change into kind of three components. And so last week was the mindset component, which is how we perceive change. And we talked about how we should expect hardship in any kind of change that's happening, and as well be deliberate in our expectations, because we quite clearly can see that our expectations influence how we experience a thing. And so being aware of that, but then taking it a step further than being aware of it and really trying to condition my expectations appropriately. There's a lot to that. If you missed last week's episode, it was a very interesting one. And as these types of topics tend to be, it wasn't written for runners specifically, but there are a lot of connections for the kinds of things we pursue, whatever they may be, including running.
Mm-hmm.
And any other goals that you have, as you have new goals or changes that you're pursuing in your own life. Here we are midway through January.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of a gut check moment. Most people are still pursuing their New Year's resolutions fairly consistently at this moment in time. But most people won't be much longer. And so which side of that most will we fall on? And you being runners, of course, are exceptional people.
Exceptional.
You are not like the rest of
the very
the world.
Best.
Yes. And so because runners are so exceptional, we also tend to be quite disciplined in our efforts and endeavors. And anyway, I'm not necessarily speaking tongue-in-cheek because I believe there are some truths in those statements. However, the effort here is to be able to use this topic to look at some of the things that we do and be able to glean from some other works how lessons that we can on what we pursue. So, that being the case, this week is the second section of the book, second of three. And so we'll be able to wrap it up then next week. And this one is, in some ways, I would say, not quite as practical, but also might be the most important. And so that's the way I tend to go about it. We are not going to try to philosophize too much here, even though
Speak for yourself.
A lot of fun. Yeah, well, I will try not to, and yet I may find myself doing so anyway. But at the same time, really getting to the heart of something that as we pursue anything, any endeavor, and especially endeavors that tend to be substantial in time and effort, we notice certain things that challenges that arise, and some of them fall under this category. So what we're going to talk about today, the second section of Stallberg's book, is the concept of identity insofar as it relates to experiencing change in life. So if last week was what we how we perceive change, and that's the mindset piece, this week is how we perceive ourselves. And that is enough of an introduction to tell you that this is going to be an interesting topic. So two sections or two chunks of this identity piece that we want to dwell on a bit here. And as Stallberg wrote them in the book, the first is this idea of sense of self. And of course, that's what identity is, essentially, is a sense of self. And especially what stands out about what Stallberg called persistence in sense of self, the things that tend to endure, or the things that tend to make something endure. And so one of the broad concepts there is this idea of complexity. And I always, anytime I start thinking about this as a runner, it's kind of like a gut check thing for runners. We look at all those studies, and in particular, the one that we often like to share, which is what happens when a runner becomes obligatory, is no longer something that I'm doing out of the joy and desire to do it and enjoyment of it, but like a sense of obligation in it, that tends to begin to produce many negative drawbacks.
And part of it is to, and I'm sure we're going to get to uphold a certain image that we want others to see and to portray and to actually convince ourselves that we are something. And so I think that as we dive into this topic, it's super helpful to think of maybe the facades that we put up or the ways that we try to prove ourselves that might be detrimental.
And that is, in fact, a consideration around this idea of like independent versus interdependent, how I'm defining myself. We'll come to that in a moment. Well, there's kind of like a series of different things here. And we're not going to try to get into everything that Stallberg wrote about in the book in particular, but some of those key ones that do stand out. So I mentioned that this complexity piece of persistence is fascinating because what it comes down to is the idea of a person who you could say suffers well, which is a strange kind of phrase to use, but is often a way of conceptualizing someone who endures, because we understand the idea that things are hard at some point, right? We experience hardship. And so if that's the case, then when we experience hardship, how do we experience it? And in this sense of multidimensional people or complex people tend to be able to endure difficulties in life or change in any sense well, or better than less multidimensional situations. And so that's a really fascinating thing. And you can compare that in some ways to, we've talked about in the past, the all-in mindset or the all-in approach. Like, this is the thing and I'm orienting everything around that thing. But then what happens when that thing gets disrupted? So the example that we always give is, because this is where I say this is the gut check for runners. I really like to run. And I have a friend in particular, if you're listening to this, you know who you are, who has suggested multi-sports could be an interesting pursuit for anyone. He has recommended, I consider it at times, and I am not opposed at all to his suggestion. In fact, I'm very interested in it, and yet find it very hard to spend time doing anything other than running when I am healthy and can run. And I can't quite concretely express why that is, except for that, well, I know why it is, because if I can run, that's the thing I want to do when given a choice. And some of it might be a kind of like a background fear of this what if sense of like, well, if I do other things, what's going to happen to the thing I like to do the most, which is the running part, you know, that kind of stuff, maybe. But there's a lot more involved in that. And the point is, we as runners are often the kind of person that says, well, yeah, I just really like to run. I don't really want to do any of those other things. So what happens for the runner when we can't, like a disruption occurs?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that answer is different for every single person who experiences that loss, at least for a time, you know, whether it be injury or something else that takes running away. I've had it several times, it be taken away. And I think having an open hand about it and knowing that isn't who I am, is that the conversation, Zach? It's not my identity. It's something I enjoy doing, and I enjoy the people in it, and I enjoy the community, but I can still foster those relationships. I can still choose movement. And there is a grieving process, though, that does happen when we're not able to do something that we're so used to doing and love to do so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to come back to it. We're posing the question now as a kind of theme then with each of these subpoints, because it is an important one, and it's inevitable. That's the piece that we have learned as runners, and Andy and Zach as people who are studying the sport in various capacities through, you know, things like research and studies. We have learned that runners get hurt quite a bit and have disruptions, not just injury, but disruptions quite a bit. It's inevitable. In fact, the statistics suggest that within the next year, you are going to have a major disruption of some kind. So if that's the case, which it probably is, what do we do about it? Well, keep that in the back of your mind, because the next layer of it that we want to assert is, as Andy was suggesting earlier, that independent versus interdependent component. And if you recall, we mentioned that Stolberg is especially interested in helping us think about this idea of non-dual thinking, as opposed to trying to say it's this or that, looking for a way to have it be both. And this is one of those examples, another one of them. And so he says, okay, it tends to be the case that people often will define themselves in one of two ways as it relates to other people, either independently, like I am whatever or whoever I am, aside from or apart from anything around me, my environment or otherwise. And so I'm independently defining myself. Or in opposition to that is this idea that I am defined by what's around me, like family and ancestry or my social context and setting or what I am capable of doing as others perceive it. And so that's where Andy was saying earlier, and I should let you talk about it because you said it.
Well, when you said that last piece, what I am capable of as others perceive it, has been a very difficult piece of my identity crises that I have experienced. And a lot of times it is more of a projected pressure that I had on myself that I thought other people had of me. And it made it very difficult for me to find joy and to pursue excellence without hindrance. I very much struggled with that because if I think other people expect things of me and I don't feel like I'm coming through, I feel like a failure and I feel afraid because I think that achievement or success is expected of me. And so that has been a difficult part of my interdependent side of identity that I've had to, it's been toxic for me that I've had to separate myself from.
And not trying to cast any kind of judgment or call any particular person out or people. But so many times as we talk with other runners, things come up like, whether or not I am disciplined and consistent depends on whether I am running with other people. You know, my running buddy got sick and couldn't run for a while, so I didn't run. Well, why could you not run when your running buddy was sick? Which, by the way, there's a lot of reasons why that may be more and less
safety
legitimate,
and
right?
Things like that.
But the point being, it can be, as we've talked with so many, it can be negative on both sides of it. So the negative on one side is I am enabled only through the interdependence, and the other side of it is I am disabled because of the interdependence, and that may be something like, well, I'm not doing the thing because I'm concerned about what other people see or perceive, or because I'm not what I think I should be right now. You know, I'm getting back into it, I'm not quite there yet, and so I don't want to go do an event that other people are going to see that I'm not quite there yet, and maybe they're going to feel something. Or so many people have said, well, I'm not posting on Strava right now because I'm just getting back into it. I'm not quite there. And it's like, well, what? Why does it matter whether or not you're at some level when you're posting a Strava?
But could be a healthy thing to not post if it's going to make you feel pressure.
I argue that you should stop posting, period, on all social things forever.
Wow.
And aside from that,
how about podcasts?
No, that's not the same thing.
Oh.
That's like saying you shouldn't publish a book if you're an author. Mm. Of course you should still do those things. But social media, insofar as it's a very, very different thing as something like a podcast or an authorship of any kind of direct kind, it's motivated differently. But anyway, my point here is that the interdependence has that potential for negativity, but also substantial potential for positivity. And I would argue, and I'm not the person making this case originally, I've heard this from other sources, but I don't think it's possible for humans to be non-social in terms of like completely separate from others in terms of my identity. And so in that sense, we are defining ourselves in some level, consciously or otherwise, based on environments and contexts and others. But is it deliberate? Is it positive? Is it incidental or negative and I'm not aware of it? Like all those kinds of things. And the case that the authors make is, as I mentioned, this is a non-dual thinking kind of scenario that they're setting up. That's one author that he set up, Stolberg. He says we probably should look for some combination of both, where my identity is something that is resilient enough that the things around me in my environment are not collapsing it or decaying it, but at the same time, it does involve those things as well. And I think that is a fairly natural expression of reality. We can't separate ourselves from everything around us, and at the same time, we also can't, shouldn't rather, be entirely dependent on things around us to define ourselves. There's some kind of middle area there.
Hmm. Yeah. How about you, Zach? What are some ways that you've seen this come up in with your sense of self as it pertains to running?
No one really wants to hear Zach talk about himself right now, so I have no idea. I didn't think of an answer to that question already, and I can't think on the fly. Zach doesn't think out loud, so I guess we'll have to come back to me.
Okay.
if I think of something. But I will add one further layer before we address the second step, which is substantiate some of this. And that is, when we're talking about this idea of defining ourselves relative to some kind of interdependence, I do think it's really important to consider the stability of the things that we are defining ourselves against. And so in that sense, something fleeting like another person's opinion of me, that's not a terribly reliable kind of barometer. Those things can change very easily, and they don't always even have anything to do with us. Like, someone else's opinion of me can change because of something happening in their own lives that has nothing to do with me. So I have to be very careful about how much stock and stake I put in other people's perceptions.
That is true. On the flip side, though, as we talk about this, I think that it's important to bring up that oftentimes we can be edified, we can see ourselves more clearly when we invite another perspective outside ourselves about how we're doing, how they perceive that things are going in our lives, if there's a specific thing that's involved, if it's a mentorship, if it's a coaching situation, if it's a parent or a friend that's close. I think there are a lot of relationships, safe relationships, that you can enter in and ask, like, hey, what do you see about in this situation? How do you think I'm handling X, Y, or Z? And it can be helpful into gaining our sense of self and seeing what things are strong and what things might need reinforcement.
I'm not going to deny that, but the point that I was going to make much deeper layer level consideration here is that the standards by which we seek that definition certainly ought to include things that are much more stable. And that's where you start to get into the existentialism of all of this. Like, you know, what are those fundamental things? And we're going to talk about this in the next one here. But if those are things that are more movable, like my health as a runner, which is a very fickle thing, I'm very easily disappointed by it, or more even seriously, drawn to despair about it because the thing lets me down. And so that's where we consider this next step, which is, how do we protect our sense of self insofar as Stolberg is laying out this idea that we need something that is stable and yet is not so fixed that it can't be influenced by new considerations. And so I think this is an important reflection because at the very deep level, certainly there's a lot that can be said about this concept. But also it's something that's super simple and practical in so many different ways. So let's address both for the sake of understanding what Stolberg is laying out and how we can apply it. But there's one quote in particular that I think kind of captures what we're saying here initially. And it came from page 103 in the book, if anyone's following along. It's about confronting and adapting to change and disorder without being so transformed by it that you no longer recognize yourself. And that's the idea of, I'm just being drawn along into something, and one day I look at the things I'm doing and how I'm spending my time and efforts and think, that's not at all what I wanted. That's not at all what I was trying to do. It's just like something happened and I have no idea when that happened along the way. So at a superficial level, we could say in education, a lot of times we talk about things like this, like the idea of boundaries are what create a sense of normal. And it's really important to have simple types of boundaries so that there is some kind of routine sense of normal. And what we do in education then is we talk to, like, teachers, you know, for example, a teacher is always looking for, what are the kind of expectations and boundaries in my classroom environment that are going to be, that will create the kind of environment we want for things. And then you have to explicitly teach those to students. You have to basically ingrain them into our consciousness as a classroom, as a group, so that it creates its own sense of momentum. Mm-hmm. Meaning, when a student breaches a boundary, that it is a kind of dissonance. Like, that's not a normal thing, and it's not okay when it happens. That's the goal with this, and it's a very simple thing.
It's interesting because boundaries aren't like a right or wrong, a moral or ethical thing all the time. It can just be something that is going to be helpful to you and the framework, like you said, setting up the foundation of what it should be like in the classroom or whatever the situation is. I had a coach for a creativity team called Odyssey of the Mind. Her name was Linda Blackmore. And one of
her name still is, actually.
Her
Linda
name
Blackmore.
Still is, and she's still one of my heroes. And she's been a mentor to me. But one of the things that she set up as a rule, as a boundary with our group, is that we weren't allowed to use the word can't.
Classic.
You can say, I haven't done that yet, or I need help to complete that. But we weren't allowed to say the word can't. And it did foster an environment of growth and problem solving. And I love her for that, because that has stuck with me for decades now.
So you can't say the word can't?
I'm choosing not to say the word can't.
But the rule is you can't say the word. So I'm actually doing this on purpose right now, because one, because Zach likes to be a contrarian as often as possible. But also, this illustrates the principle that you have exceptions to all things, right? Context matters. You, of course, can say the word can't when it's things like, we can't throw those glass bottles at each other's faces. We can't do that, right? But as it pertains to a certain aspect of what we're doing, we can't say the word. That's where you see the multiple layers of the thing. Yeah, I like it. It's a good one. Good example, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for contrarianing Linda's thing. All right, so if that's the principle, like we have to have a sense of boundaries, how to establish those boundaries as they pertain to our identities, you could say, then is this idea that Stolberg brings about. He talks about core values. And this is where it all kind of comes back to tying everything together. And this is very important for us as we're talking about this on the podcast right now. We shared last week that we were going to get into this. There are things more important than running, obviously. And insofar as that is true, there are also times when we have to make decisions about what we're doing as we pursue some goal or some desire or some change. We have to make decisions that may be counter to some of our goals and desires in favor of other things. When we make those decisions, we ought to have some kind of guiding what's creating a sense of what's important for us. And that's where this idea, as Stolberg illustrates it, is he actually, as a life coach, apparently he does some aspect of life coaching as well. As a life coach, he talks with people about, let's create a list of what are some of the, and he calls it 3 to 5, gives it a number, 3 to 5 of the kind of the most important things, the core values. And then you write a statement about it that clarifies it. And then you come up with examples, like, how do I actually practice that in day-to-day living? Like, what does that actually look like when I'm just living my life normally? And that exercise is important, because if we don't deliberately consider, like, what is most important to me and for my sense of self, but also for my life, like at a day-to-day living kind of level, then things tend to just happen. And we would argue that things that just happen by themselves will invariably bring about some kind of problem, some kind of conflict or tension at some point. And that's where we talk about this with our runners a lot, which is, what is creating the dissonance? I'm feeling like, you know, there's some difficulty, some struggle in making this thing happen, whether it's training or other aspects of life. What's creating the dissonance, and what's most important there? And how do we make sure we keep that mindset? So that's where we would say, we would always be the first to say that running is pretty low on the list of the kinds of things that are most important to people. And yet at the same time, we also all understand that most of these things have a kind of shifting ebb and flow. And so there may be some times when running is more important than other times. And you've got, you know, this season I'm training for a big marathon. I've never done the Chicago Marathon before, and I finally got in. So it's going to take a little bit higher priority than it has in the past. Winter and training is awful, and things are a lot more difficult than they normally are. Running takes a little bit lower priority, like things like that, right? So we would argue that that is a healthy way to approach something like our favorite sport of running.
So when you look at like core values, Zach, do you think that it could be something like, I want to show up, be disciplined, be someone that people can count on? You know, that type of aspect that actually is the underlying purpose of our running. Because I don't think that most people, when they look down at the core of what they're proud of about their running, it's not like the certain time, but it's the fact that they woke up early in the morning to get the training in, that they pushed through discomfort, that they were able to transform themselves to become better. You know, I think that those, if I'm kind of hearing this right about the core values, those might be a value that even if you didn't have running, there could be some element of that that you continue to pursue that you're proud of.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so examples include and things like self-discipline, as you're expressing it, Andy. Very much is the type of thing when people talk about this idea. Now, once again, an argument can be made that there are some core values that are less substantial and may have may not be quite as core enough than others. So like hard work and self-discipline are pretty core, you could say, but like being fit, which you can see is kind of a layer removed from hard work and self-discipline. Like hard work and self-discipline likely will produce things like being fit if you're pursuing some activity like a sport like running, but not necessarily. And being fit of itself is an end that you don't necessarily always control, right?
Right.
You can always be hardworking and self-disciplined, regardless of your state of existence, but you can't always be fit. You don't always have that option available to you. So that's where I would say it goes back to my original point earlier, and I wanted to make the point then, but really underscore it now, which is that there we need to have, as we try to anchor ourselves in these kinds of things that are substantial and stable. The kind of stuff that should be at the very center of what's driving how we define ourselves and the things that are important in our lives should be as stable as possible. And in fact, we ought to be able to have those kinds of things be the kinds of things that we can layer anything that's going on around us on top of them and have them remain largely the same. And so that's where Stolberg would argue that those things don't necessarily stay. They're not permanent inherently. Some may well be for your entire life, pretty permanent, but they can potentially change, and yet they shouldn't change easily. That's one of the pieces. Now, I would argue there are some core values that we should be able to have that would never change. Things like love, for example, like the idea of being loving probably should not be contextual in some sense. Like there's a lot of different ways we could describe what I mean when I say being loving, but so there in the point to be made here that there are some things that are much less likely to be able to change than other things, but we should look for, as we're trying to identify what's important to me and how is that then influencing how I perceive myself and how I do the things that I do. That's an important exercise. And I don't know that I'm telling everyone here that you need to sit down right now, and if you don't have 5 core values, you need to write them out. And if you want to do that, that sounds like an interesting thing to do, certainly. But more importantly, we should be deliberate enough in the way we go about things that we do have a clear sense of priority and importance in our lives.
I can give an example of one of my core values, core thoughts about myself, my self-perception. And it's something that I'm striving for, so I don't hit it on all the time. But I believe that God has created me to be a life giver. And so with my words, I try to be life-giving with how I act towards people and how I demonstrate kindness. I try to be life-giving. So that is one of my core values, that even when other things may change or life circumstances happen, I can still be a life-giver.
Yeah, right on. And then in that, you can see that also then prioritizes, when we talk about prioritizing, that also prioritizes how you respond to situations and people. And so I have many options in whatever's happening around me. And I can choose many different courses of action. Why would I choose some over others? And these are the kinds of things that should inform that choice more than a moment's emotion or a moment's reaction. Now, we're actually starting to get into next week's topic, which these things ought to be that way, right? Topics ought to naturally move into each other. And so the final section is in some ways the practical aspect, because it's the application of these ideas, and that is actions. And so what are the actions that we would take as a response to change around us if we're thinking about these mindset and identity considerations? So we're going to get into that next week to wrap it all up, and then we'll be able to illustrate the principles in some other examples coming soon as well.
Great conversation. Thanks, Zach. Now on to the world of running. First off, congratulations to some A to Z runners. Laura Sheets, who was first overall woman at the Snowman Half, and Dan O and Ben ran the Frostbite Relay. And that was an appropriate name because it was insane this past weekend. Those races were run in Michigan and it was bonkers.
Foot of snow.
It was crazy. Laura wore ski goggles and she was unrecognizable. She was like a running ninja. It was, just crazy weekend for it. So congrats to these A to Z runners for enduring the cold.
Laura reminded me in her outfit of what you would see in like a James Bond movie, where you know how all the villains on the snowmobiles all have like these, they're totally concealed and you can't see any person behind all of their like ninja snow outfits. Yeah, that's what she looked like. So a James Bond villain, I guess. But she's really a hero.
And congrats to everybody who ran their runs outside or on a treadmill this past weekend. If you had variable weather like we did in the West Michigan area, way to get it done.
We talked about that. It was rough.
It was.
And props to you, whatever you did to try to deal with it. So, elsewhere in the world, it wasn't 2 feet of snow, Ian.
It was not.
And people were running very fast.
Very fast. There's something about Houston. There's just something about it because...
Yeah, it's a really fast course.
That's it is. It. And people tend to run super well here. In the half marathon, it was won by Sutum Kebebe in a time of 64:37 on the women's side. It's the fastest ever on U.S. soil. It's called the U.S. all-comers record. And that moves her to a tie for 9th on the all-time list in the world.
That is very fast.
Yes. It was more than a 3-minute PR for Kebede.
That is also very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And she beat Helen Obiri, which is saying something, because Obiri She's pretty hard to beat right now.
She is.
In anything.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So that was fast. But then also for the Americans, it was fast. It was the third straight year the record was broken in Houston.
No kidding.
Yes.
I know
that's why I said something
last
about
year,
Houston.
Three in a row?
Yeah. So Sarah Hall, 67-15 in 2022. Emily Sisson, 66-52 in 2023. Then Kira D'Amato snuck in with her amazing run that she did in Australia in July. And she lowered Sisson's record to 66-39. And now the new record holder is Wayne Colati.
Wayne Colati.
In her half marathon debut.
Which is why I say in the introduction, an unexpected, or at least for many, it would have been unexpected. And yet, entering the scene with authority.
With authority. Fourth overall in the race, which was highly competitive. And I'm excited because Colati is running the U.S. champion, or not the, yeah, the U.S. Cross Country Championships next weekend in Richmond. And because this was her debut, that does not mean that she's qualified for the U.S. Olympic trials because that window has closed.
Yeah.
So she is not running in the marathon trials. She typically runs the 5K, 10K distances. And I read an interview, and I guess her coach built her up to higher volumes for this cycle. She's typically been on the lower end of normal for 5K, 10K. So she was apprehensive about it, but her coach built her up, so she was doing higher volumes, and it paid off big time, obviously. So she might be looking at long-distance racing in the future, but of course she's got a lot of accolades for the shorter distances, too. In fact, on the road racing circuit, it's not uncommon to hear her as a podium finisher. She's won some U.S. championships as well. So Wayne Colati, new American half marathon record holder.
Yeah, I would argue that I haven't seen anything that would say she was definitely going to run that fast in a half.
No, you knew she would do well, but this is surprising to, I think, most people, even probably to Wayne Colati, how quickly she ran her debut.
It is an interesting thing to me that, so right now it's like, if you break a women's road running record in the United States, your assumption has to be you're not likely to sit on that record for very long, because none of them seem to last altogether that long at the moment. Even the marathon record, which for quite some time Dina Castor sat on that one, and then it dropped a couple of times in quick succession. But what stands out to me is that, in particular, if you are Kira D'Amato, it's really unfortunate that every time you break a record, someone does it again shortly after you, and you don't get to hang on to it for very long. That's got to be a little bit frustrating, at least. But
and Emily Sisson, too, because she had the record.
Well, she
then D'Amato got the record.
Record,
I know, I know, but they kind of went back and forth, the two of them, because Kira D'Amato had the marathon record.
Yeah.
Emily Sisson broke that, and then Emily Sisson had the half marathon record, and Kira D'Amato broke that. So it's a lot of back and forth, but here's the good thing that you can hear from all of this is that the U.S. women are on the rise. They're getting better and better. We're showing up with a lot of amazing U.S. women. So, yeah, it'll be exciting to see the Olympic trials.
Yeah. Well, speaking of exciting things, important to note that people were watching some of the finishers of the Houston races to kind of get a sense of like what to anticipate from the trials, because a number of people running in the Olympic marathon trials on February 3 were using Houston as a kind of
tune-up
race. So, interestingly enough, some things happened that made people think, now that makes me change some of my predictions for the trials in February. So that's always kind of fascinating to me. Namely, among them, the one that stands out to most people is that Galen Rupp did not have a phenomenal race at Houston. That doesn't really change anything about what I think about Galen Rupp and his marathon capacity at the U.S. Olympic trials, because Galen Rupp has never been one to like always have this great tune-up race before his big moments.
And it wasn't terrible.
It's not terrible. He's just didn't compete as well as like he. It's not
who
that,
knows the intention
it's not the
of
time.
It.
It's whether or not he.
Maybe
right.
He's running it at marathon effort.
Well,
who knows?
No, but the point being, again, and that may be part of it. Who knows exactly what Galen Rupp was doing and or what he's willing to do that close to the race, because Galen Rupp is a very deliberate runner, has been his entire career, and so it stands to reason that you shouldn't read too much into anything that happens except for the one, you know, the big one.
Biasimbassa of the USA was the top American finisher in a time of 60:45, and you'll recognize that name if you listen to this podcast, because he was a name that we called out lots of times on the road racing circuit as a top three finisher and champion.
Yeah, you'll also recognize that name if you were following the road circuit and you saw all of his many exceptional finishes. Some good things, certainly, from Houston. It's always exciting. We certainly congratulate Zuhair Taubi,
yes,
for the marathon win.
Yeah, so he's a previous podcast guest. He's from Morocco, and he trains in the USA. And he ran a time of 2:06:39, which boosts his chances for Olympic selection to represent Morocco. And he won the race, which is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I would have been shocked if he wasn't selected for the Olympic team prior to that, but now with that under his belt as well, we'll see. But
very exciting.
Certainly that. Speaking of exciting,
it just seems unreal. So we're going to share this bit of news, but we're still a little bit in disbelief about it.
Well, for good reason. Okay, let me say this before we share the results. There's some widespread skepticism around this one in particular, and it's not necessarily like that one person ran so fast that that's making me skeptical, but so many people ran so much faster than they ever had before that when that happens in one race, it raises questions about, like, is it possible that the course was a little short, or that they like did something wrong in the course that was, you know, just a small thing that changed a little bit about it, that kind of stuff? Or is it just like the course is set, you know, it's a downhill 10K kind of thing? Like, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? So there's some skepticism. We'll tell you what happened, and then we'll watch the airwaves and see what news continues to come of it.
Mm-hmm. So the women's world record 10K on the road was broken by Agnes
Nigetic
in the time of 28:46.
Also broken by the second place finisher in the same race, Immaculate Anyango. So 28:46.
28:46. So
for
she's
10,000 meters.
Right. And she's the first woman, and then the second woman was second place, to break the 29-minute barrier, crushing the record set by Lielensverf Yuala in 2022 by 28 seconds. 28. Okay. Nagetic's 10K time is also faster than the women's world record for the distance on the track, just set by Lentezabet Gede, which is 29:01.03. So no woman ever, ever, ever anywhere had run faster than 29 minutes, even on the track. And then she crushed it.
Yeah.
To run 28:46.
And second place also bested it. So that's why those are more evidences to suggest there's something uncommon about this particular event.
The unofficial mid-race 5K split, this is unofficial, so this is just from, you know, what people have said about it. She also ran 14:12, which is faster than the road 5K record as well.
Yeah.
So that's also incredible. And this was also, I had read this and I did not verify for myself, so take it with a grain of salt, that it's the highest scoring female performance. They rate performances compared to others in history and how fast they believe it is compared to other disciplines. And this is the highest scoring female performance of all time over Sydney McLaughlin's 400 hurdle world record.
Oh, and that's something.
Yeah.
That record's like one of the most insane records relative to others in the event ever. Okay, so yes, that should tell you something. That should tell you this. Now, what we forgot to add here, the caveat is Agnes Nigetic is not one of the best distance runners in the world. She's good. She's rock solid and she's up there, but she's not a Sifan Hassan, a Lentezabet Gede, a Faith Kipyegon. She's not on their level. So the fact that she just ran that fast on the roads and others in the race also were running so much insanely faster than they have is where the skepticism really takes root.
Mm-hmm. Nagetich will now focus on the World Athletics Cross Country Championships in March. So we'll get to see her compete against others there to see if there is such a large discrepancy with her and the rest of the world. And then she does plan to compete in Paris for the Olympic Games this summer.
Yeah, which, by the way, this was something that a whole lot of conversation started on a thread of why does this road race have anything to do with the Olympics, too. In case you weren't aware, there's a number of things that have been strange about qualifying for the Olympics this year. One of them was the addition that a 10,000-meter track runner can qualify with a few different events, not just running 10,000 meters on a track. And so the World Cross Country Championships is one that helps you qualify for the Olympic track event, and certain road race accolades as well. So this kind of an accomplishment by Nagetich does boost her chances of representing Kenya for the 10,000-meter track events, despite the fact that it is not a track race. Okay.
Briefly, on the men's side, it was no surprise that Jacob Kiplimo of Uganda was the first place finisher in a time of 26:48. Now, moving on to just one brief note about a fast collegiate runner. As you know, the indoor season has begun and youngsters are flying, per usual, I guess, lately. But Yusuf Bizimana ran the collegiate record in the 1,000-meter run, which is near and dear to my heart because it's a weird one, but I ran it indoor in college. And he clocked a time of 2:18.26. This isn't surprising, seeing as he is the reigning NCAA Division I indoor 800-meter champion. But he moves up to the number 4 in all of British history. And this might be interesting to you, Zach. He has an NIL with On Athletics. On is getting those NIL deals.
That they are. If they can't be a shoe sponsor of a school, which they are not currently in NCAA, they're at least gaining quite a bit of attention by putting their name on a bunch of these popular collegiate athletes.
Yeah.
Winning the popularity contest, which is what the NIL thing is all about. All right. So that's fascinating. Now, there is one other thing. A bonus, and I didn't tell Andy we were going to talk about this, but it's really interesting, so we wanted to share it. The United States Olympic Marathon Team Trials are coming up very soon. We'll keep you posted on that as it unfolds. Interestingly, some insider information for you.
Are you allowed to share this? Did they
I have
put
no
any
idea.
Disclaimers before you started the
I didn't
meeting?
Have to sign anything anywhere, so it doesn't matter to me what they think is or is not private information. No, I'm kidding. This is not private information. There was a recent webinar, in like a Q&A for the athletes about some of the details surrounding the event, and one of the questions that came up, and it's funny to me because it was asked near the end of the Q&A time, and it made the Q&A go like half an hour longer than was intended, than was planned, which I just find to be so funny. But what happens is the participants, you don't know exactly who is asking what because most of them were anonymous participants, but they started asking about the qualification for the Olympic team. And as you know, we've shared it on air here, this is a very strange situation because for the first time, I believe, ever since the U.S. started doing a marathon trials, there's a very odd, not guaranteed situation. So for the men's side, in recap here, there are only two guaranteed spots for Team USA in the Olympics in the marathon currently, meaning that we've only got two actual qualifications. Now, that being the case, it doesn't have to be those two people who qualify. Essentially, the way it works is you unlock two spots for your country. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff involved in that. There's a way for the third spot to get unlocked after the fact, and it's most likely going to happen. So the assumption right now is that three runners for the men, Team USA, will in fact still go to the Olympics. But the question surrounds what the U.S. is going to do about that third spot. And what they had said, and we shared this on air, is that Team USA will honor the finishing places of the Olympic trials. So if you're in first, second, or third place, you're going to the Olympics. If, as long as you have run 2:11:30 or faster prior to the trials, which makes sense because the Olympic Committee specifically has set that line of 2:11:30 as the minimum. You at least have to have run that time regardless of everything else. However, that does not qualify you for the Olympics. You need to be ranked high enough to qualify for the Olympics or have run 2:08 or faster. So the rule is if you're in the top 80 or you've run 2:08 or faster, you're in, right? And then if you're in the top 80 and you've run slower than 2:11:30, now we're in a sticky situation.
You could also run the 2:11:30 at the trials.
Yeah. Well, hang on. We'll get to that.
Okay.
But the point is, if your country unlocked a spot because you have someone who's ranked in the top 80, and then the person who's ranked in the top 80 that unlocked that spot does not go to the Olympics, then your country can pick anyone else you want, right? In theory. That's why they have the 2:11:30 line for the Olympic Committee, because they're basically saying you can pick anyone you want as long as they're fast enough. And so that's where that comes from. You've got to unlock the spot first, and then as long as someone has run 2:11:30 or faster. So then the U.S. runs into the situation where we say, okay, well, we've unlocked three spots, assuming we get the third. What if someone finishes in the top three in the U.S. Olympic trials but is not ranked in the top 80 in the world and has not run 2:11:30 or faster? Do they go to the Olympics? And the answer is no, in theory, right? Because they don't meet that requirement that the Olympic Committee has set forth. So then the reaction to that is, well, what are their options? Does that mean you're it? That's it? They just go to the next person on the list? Or can you do something after the Olympic trials to try to improve your circumstances? And this is where the question started to get weird. So then people started asking, okay, can you chase like improving your ranking after the fact? And the answer is yes, from the Olympic standpoint. You can improve your ranking up to the end of March, I think it is. It's like April sometime. And so if you do run other races and you finish well enough at a qualified event, then you can potentially get into the top 80, even if you weren't before, and that puts you in a qualifying state. Now, what got weird was when the representative for Team USA said, but the United States is not going to let people chase the time, the 2:11:30 time. And what they mean is they don't want anyone to run a marathon between the Olympic trials and the Olympic Games. And in fact, they actually said outright on the call, if you run a marathon in between the two, we're not going to let you run the Olympic game. Like, you disqualify yourself for it. Their point specifically was in response to the question, okay, so what if you run the Boston Marathon and win it? Which, by the way, would qualify you for the Olympics. There are a few like guaranteed things. Top five in a World Marathon Majors event is an automatic qualifier for the Olympics. It puts you within the window to qualify. Okay, so they're like, okay, what if you do that? And they're like, well, yeah, that's great. You unlock another spot for Team USA, but it's not going to be you. If you did that, if you went to Boston this year and won the Boston Marathon and finished top three in the U.S. Olympic trials, you wouldn't get to go to the Olympics because you ran that marathon. That's how crazy, right? It started to get so many questions started to come out because people are like, well, what about this situation? What about this situation? And it's like, so what you're telling us is basically no matter what you do, if you're not ranked well enough and you finish top three, that we're not going to let you do anything about it in between the two. And to his credit, one of the representatives insisted that that just simply wouldn't happen. You would not have a situation where someone has been able to qualify for the Olympics but hasn't run fast enough, that 2:11:30. He's like, everyone is going to be way faster than that on that list. And so we're just not that worried about it. But it does create some incentive for the American men in the Olympic trials to have a little bit faster race.
It's going
to
be a faster race.
Because if the top 10 all run under 2:11:30, then no one's concerned about it, right? It's not a big deal. If the top three do, then no one's concerned about it. It's not a big deal. But traditionally, the Olympic trials has been an uncommonly slow race.
Tactical.
So, especially because it's held in Orlando, which tends to be hotter this time.
Well, and Atlanta was not fast.
And Atlanta was a slow course. It was a hilly course.
Yeah.
So we'll see. That's now you've got the inside scoop. You probably are thinking, why did I need to know that? Because it's weird. That's why.
It's interesting.
It's interesting. And it just makes for a little bit of drama around that that Olympic trials race.
So it'll be so fun. Can't wait. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.